keep them in your home or love to see them in theirs. These are the creatures that bring us all together.
Reptiles. We're going to be delving into the experiences of reptile lovers from around the block and around the world. This is the Reptile Talk Podcast. What's up, everybody? This is Jeremy Turgeon from Brassman Reptile.
And I'm Robin. I'm Creeping It Real. We got a very special guest tonight in our podcast kind of theme.
Yes.
With the most recent episodes. We've got Sergio Phelan from Port City Pet. How are you doing tonight, man?
I'm doing good, guys. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Absolutely. Most and definitely. From the Ground Up podcast. So it's another reptile podcast. If you haven't checked it out yet, you should go check it out.
Boom.
Yeah. So how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. I just got back from work. I just fed the geckos, and everyone's cool. I'm actually about to spray them down, so don't mind. I'll try to make as little noise as possible.
So for people who haven't been following you or might not know who you are, how did you kind of get your start in reptiles? Is it something that you were like lifelong lifer and you just like always been in it, or is it something you got into gradually?
My dad has been keeping snakes since the 70s, mm-hmm. and not really in a way in which we see today or in the numbers in which a lot of people keep.
Yeah.
You know, he just had an occasional Burmese python, occasional boa, because like apparently you have to get a Burmese python or a boa in the 70s and 80s.
Pretty much.
So that's kind of, I grew up in a house that was cool with that kind of stuff, and we had a bunch of reptiles growing up. I went to the White Plains Reptile Show when I was a kid, like rather often, mm-hmm. and we'd catch garter snakes in the backyard. We had a pond in which we would catch frogs and stuff like that. So yeah, I've always been, it was nothing in which I was like totally enthralled about. I mean, I loved Steve Irwin. I loved reptiles in general, but I didn't really get heavy into it in the, say, the numbers or the seriousness until I was probably like 22 or so when I got out of the, or got back from basic training out of the Army and went back to school, and kind of rediscovered a snake that I in my parents' house. I needed to take it back after they took care of it for a while. Then I was like, wow, this is the coolest thing. Mm. And it was a corn snake. And then, so I've always loved corn snakes, and then I kind of, you know, I got sidetracked and got a bunch of ball pythons, and I fucked up, right?
It's easy to do.
Dude, and you know what? It's if it gets you more invested in it and doing, you know, more, because it's a stepping stone for a lot of people from, you know, having one snake or a couple snakes to having a bunch of snakes and really getting, you know, enveloped in reptiles. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, it can be one thing when, like, the person's like, oh, well, I just want to make money. But if you're like, I like reptiles and I like, you know, ball pythons, there's nothing wrong with that, I don't think.
Yeah. And I think I always I took a little bit of a mentality in which, like, yeah, I was going to breed those snakes. And I did kind of – at the time, I mean, we're probably talking 2012 to 2013 or so. Mm-hmm. The ball python market was so like marketed as such.
Yeah,
it was so heavy business. Reptile radio, all these guys were talking about, you know, turning ones into twos as far as dollars go. Yep. And using mm-hmm. snakes to do it. Mm-hmm. So it's like I felt like I got caught in the minutia of that, and I feel like a lot of people did at that time.
Yeah.
And I think now we're seeing that all unwind and people getting more into what they're actually into and less about like investing and all that stuff. And I guess I was lucky enough to kind of lose my shirt when I was young, dumb, and poor anyway. So I mean it didn't work out, right? But I mean, it's totally fine. It was a great learning experience, and then I learned what I do and what I don't like as far as keeping and breeding animals for sure. Mm-hmm.
And then, so going from, you know, being a kid and you know, seeing your parents keeping or your dad keeping stuff, and then, you know, working with some of your own stuff, you've kind of changed and evolved a lot as you've gone. And even just like listening to your podcast, the different things that you're working with have changed and evolved as you've gone. And then you're getting more into like the isopods and the bioactive stuff to, and you're doing supplies and selling that sort of stuff. So what kind of evolution was that? How did that kind of go for you?
Well, I felt that a lot of people that I had looked up to, I had heard some advice from some individuals to say, stay focused, you know, see it through, see your projects through and stuff like that. And I do that. But I have, honestly, man, I usually get bored if I hatch out the same thing twice in a row. So as far as animals go,
yeah,
like if I can't further a project to a certain amount, even though I may keep, so right now I'm actually selling a lot of breeding animals and like keeping one as a pet. So like I had Eastern black king snakes. I love those snakes. I bred them a couple times. Both times the babies were so hard to get started and all that stuff. Yeah. And I love the species, but I'm like, how cool is it to just have the one baby that I hand raised and then I'm going to set it up all nice and like really appreciate it. So I'm kind of in a weird trajectory as far as breeding animals goes, but I realize that the energy and the passion actually, it helps being less focused. It helps saying, oh shit, here's gargoyle geckos. Like I have 10 gargoyle geckos in front of me and I didn't give any cares to them, you know, the last 7 years I've been looking at these things, but all of a sudden they just kind of caught my eye and now I really love them. But it also informed my snake keeping and informed my substrate mixes and informed the isopositor in there, the springtails. So now I know if I ever have a customer who wants to use, you know, some type of substrate or wants to use a certain cleanup crew, now I have advice to give them. Because, I mean, so many people have gargoyle geckos and crested geckos, and now I kind of understand how amazing they are, as well as I understand a lot more how to keep them.
Yeah, for sure. I think that when people pigeonhole themselves into one section, like, you know, they just say, okay, I'm only going to work with corn snakes and that's it. I'm not gonna do anything. That can be great if you're looking at like breeding and stuff like that. But when it comes to your overall care and how you work with and interact with those animals, it's better to have a sampling of different things. So, you know, you might not keep your, you know, crested geckos or the same way that you're gonna keep your corn snakes. But when you're looking at your care and your substrate, the way that you may approach your juveniles and your babies, things that you can learn from working with a different type of reptile can definitely lend to working, making you better doing the stuff that you're actually, you're more interested in. And, you know, I think the saying is like, calm seas don't make for good sailors. You know, you got to kind of go through the test to be able to be really considered good at something. And that's kind of what you're saying is that, you know, from working with your gargoyles, you've kind of got a better feel for how you might do things differently with any of your other bioactive stuff.
Oh yeah, 100%. And that's kind of, I think keeping reptiles in general, especially when you get to a certain number of animals, you leave yourself really open to failure in a lot of ways.
Yes.
So yeah, you may have one gecko and everything goes great and stuff like that, but that's, you know, a sample size of one. You're working with 10. You find out kind of what works with what. Then you go to 20, 30. I mean, you know, you guys work in a facility in which,
yeah,
I mean, you're probably talking hundreds. So, I mean, just the amount of knowledge, you gain so much more knowledge in having more snakes. You know, there could be a guy who has a collection of 5 corn snakes for 20 years. Honestly, the person who has, you know, 200 corn snakes for 5 years probably knows more. It's kind of accelerated learning just by the amount of numbers and the sample size. You get all these different situations and stuff that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. I definitely feel that way, especially like when you start thinking about ailments in mm-hmm. reptiles. You know, if you only have one or two of a particular species, you might not really see anything, any kind of major ailments, because, you know, first of all, like, you're generally, if you've only got a couple animals, your husbandry is going to be super on point, and you're probably going to be staring at those animals every day. If you have, you know, 50 or so, you know, especially with the same species, your sample size, you know, like you're saying, is larger, so you're going to see different quirks. You know, you might see, like, you know, I think about ball pythons, for instance, like some ball pythons might be on a lower part of a rack system when you start doing temp drops, might pop an RI, you know, but the rest of your rack doesn't, you know, or you just start to see different things that more often than not is only ever read about or only ever seen in situations where there's a large sample size of animals in one area.
Yeah, 100%. And there's also, you know, there's certain things that come associated with even certain projects in animals, certain genetics in animals, in which aren't really known to the public, and you learn once you hatch out 15 of them. like this gene, over time, the last 3 years, has been the hardest clutch to start. Yeah, there's something right. there. I mean, they're related, so maybe it's just something that is inherited from the parents that were picky feeders, or maybe it's the function of the gene is actually changing something in the animal.
Yeah.
And to note, you can't know those distinctions, which kind of sucks, which is why I kind of, I don't know, I've weeded out a lot of projects because of even things like that, just not the highest quality genetics for one reason or another.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like piebald ball pythons tend to be a little bit more picky than some of the other mutations and morphs, and then like you got the jag carpet pythons that got their wobble that's even crazier than the spider ball python wobble, and you got like the zebra carpets that they'll have knots in their tails sometimes when they're born, and there's like all these little things that, you know, if you've had one, you know, carpet python, you're not going to know that,
right?
But if you are producing carpet pythons, or you've got, you know, 50 or 60 or 80 or 100 of them, it's probably something that is you will run into. And dealing with that can definitely put a challenge to your keeping.
Oh, yeah. And there are certain things in which that's kind of an emotional and mental game come into it, too, because it can be super disappointing with when you're really counting on things.
Yeah, yeah. I can't tell you how many people who have never bred things before, they produce a couple clutches and they'll lose, you know, two or three babies, just failure to thrive, animals that just were small, didn't absorb all their yolk, or, you know, this, that, or the other thing happened, and they lose a couple animals, and they're like, I don't even want to breed animals anymore. This is terrible. Like, I love this animal so much. I got to hatch it out in my own hands, and it's like, you know, that's something that not a lot of people talk about. I mean, there's probably more people who talk about it now than in the early 2000s and the 90s and everything.
Yeah.
But still, people don't realize that there are those situations where you can have this animal that you're like, oh, I've been waiting on this one particular thing to hatch out, and then it just does not thrive. It doesn't do well. And despite, you know, your best efforts of force feeding or assist feeding or doing all that you can, sometimes there's nothing you can do that to keep that animal going.
And this is kind of my time of year for this is where kind of all the picky feeders, it's kind of the make or break type of moment.
Yeah.
In which, so this is why I feel like I'm being probably a bummer about it, but let's talk about more fun things.
So you have gone through different evolutions, and you've got a couple pythons still, right? Maybe?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have a decent collection. I mean, a normal person would think it's a collection.
So what would you say is like your favorite python to work with?
Ooh, so that goes back and forth a lot, but really the one constant is probably my olive python.
That's what I was hoping you were going to say.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fair.
And it's really not, I don't know. It's kind of the individual animal just as much as it is the species. I only have one. Water python, I only have one.
Mm-hmm.
I think 90% of people don't have good experiences with their water pythons.
Yeah.
And mine has been just incredible. So it's like, I may not like water pythons, but I do like my water python.
For sure.
That's fair. Yeah.
I love olive pythons. I think they're super underrated. And I feel like a lot of the people who think that they want a reticulated python, what they actually want is an olive python. Because they've got that super glossy, smooth feel to them. They get to a decent size, but they're not unmanageable. Like, you know, an 11-foot olive python is a very, you know, intimidating animal. But the majority of them are not nutcases like some retics can be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, definitely food aggressive. Definitely, something in which when you're behind the tongs, you're like, that feels different. a very strong animal, probably not much different than a retic. I mean, retic is a giant strong animal, but it's kind of the olive python probably doesn't get as much love because although for us it's cool, especially having like a patternless snake, there's only so many genera of patternless snakes, and Liasis, the water python, the olive python are one of the really small few.
Yeah.
So it's like people think probably the normal individual probably thinks it's a drab, like gray snake. But to us, I mean, it looks so, so cool.
Yeah,
100%.
If you haven't had the chance, like if you're listening and you haven't had a chance to like handle an all of Python, find someone who's got one and ask them if you can hold it, because it'll change your mind about them.
That's very
like,
true.
I didn't feel really one way or another about them until I held a couple like 10 or 11 foot ones, and I was like, oh my God, this snake is so awesome. Why do people why do people keep retics? These are just as cool. I don't get it. I mean, I get the retics have all the crazy colors and everything, but like for size reasons, you're not gonna throw your back out picking up a all the python.
True.
Yeah, that is the nice thing. It, you know, it doesn't rearrange the furniture, it doesn't, you know, choke you out or do anything like that.
Yeah. So what kind of drew you to corn snakes? Is it just like, you know, nostalgia reasons, or how do you feel about corns? Because I just now am kind of gaining an appreciation for corn snakes. When I was younger, I never really, if someone was like, hey, look at this corn snake, I'd be like, get out of here. Don't talk to me. I'm looking at pythons right now.
Your domestic species.
Yeah. I was like, you can find those around, like not here, but like you can find those close to my area. I'm not interested in that. But they are like one of the most popular pet snakes. And honestly, when people ask what kind of pet snake they should get first, I usually end up telling them either a ball python or a corn snake.
Yeah, I mean, that's really it, is that I love them for a myriad of reasons, but one of the reasons is definitely the fact that it's a great pet, and I can have confidence pretty much selling it to anyone.
Yes.
And once I get that animal eating, they're going to have a good experience. So that's really my main concern, is like passing it on. As far as if I was to breed 200 retics, would I be able to guarantee that? I don't know. Yeah. So I mean, having corn snakes, yeah, I mean, for that reason, 100%. But also, just honestly, it has the attentiveness. It has, like, visually, it's paying attention. It's an active snake. It's kind of like, and people probably don't like this comparison, but it does have a similar niche to, say, the carpapythons or Morelia. I mean, to me, they have the same kind of, they move around very similar and stuff like that. I just think they're really attentive and really cool. It's just kind of, when you hold it, they're not going to bite you. They're just kind of going to explore and, yeah, I love the handleability of them.
Yeah. I like that you can also kind of market it as a animal that you can set up a nice enclosure for it, and it will utilize that nice enclosure, because like you give a ball python, you know, and even an adult ball python, a big 75-gallon enclosure, and you put branches in there and stuff, you might see it move around once a month, if that. Like, you're not going to see, it's going to hide most of the time, and it's probably not going to be very comfortable. But you take an adult corn snake and put it in a 75-gallon with all these branches and things, you're going to see that corn snake use every inch of that enclosure all the time. Yeah. They're just so variable, and they're very, like, forgiving of keeper error. So, like, you can kind of keep them almost however you want, and they do really well. And that's one of the things that I always try and tell people when they're getting into snakes. Like, when they're babies, corn snakes can be a little nippy or, like, whatever. They're a little squirrely or whatever. But after they get a little bit bigger, once they hit, like, that foot mark, they just, like, mellow right down. And most of them are just, like, super chill animals, very curious. And they're pleasing to have in your home to, like, look at and to observe.
Yeah, I've had corn snakes since I was, I believe it was kindergarten. And I brought one in for first grade. But the different ways that I've kept them over the years, and they're all wrong.
quote wrong, yeah.
Like, you know, I had them in a critter keeper, or I had them in a 10-gallon with a heat rock. I've had them with no heat at all. That was a method that we did for a while, just straight up room temp. Mm-hmm. Totally, at like 70 degrees, it's fine. And then as I got older, you know, I started doing 85-degree hot spot, room temperature cool. And then once I got so many, I started doing ambient room temps, going from 80 to 82 in the summer, 82 to 84, just natural fluctuation.
Yeah.
And they've all worked. Mm-hmm. For the babies, you've got to be a little bit more particular starting off.
Yeah.
Once they're adults, though, you can do anything to that animal. It's incredible.
Pretty much. That's one of the things that I've told people. I'm like, you can almost keep them however you want. Like, if you wanted to make, like, a sandy coastal enclosure with, like, half sand, half dirt, they'd probably be fine with it. You could do a deep forest one where it's all just dirt, and you could do your you know, your isopods and do bioactive like in the in a forest, and they're gonna do great. You could do them on paper towels, you can do them on newspaper, you can do pretty much however you want, and they are gonna do fantastic as long as you're making sure that they stay hydrated, you're giving them food, and you give them a place to digest their food at an appropriate temperature. You can pretty much change just about anything else, and they don't really care.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a species that the northernmost range is southern New Jersey, and then the southernmost is the Keys of Florida. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, that's a pretty, pretty wide
tropical
range.
Yeah.
Yeah,
tropical to New Jersey.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, I certainly do appreciate that flexibility of the species. You know, because so many other species. I mean, even if you think about like. Not even really going too far away from that, but you look at like a lot of Lampropeltis species, like mm-hmm. they get too cold, they're just not gonna thrive, you know. But the corn snakes can certainly tolerate that quite a bit more. I definitely don't recommend chilling your corn snakes except for brumation. But
I was gonna say brumation, what are you talking about? They can people putting them in fridges almost like for the winter.
Definitely some like honorable mention for, you know, things like Morelia and stuff. I've always found those great to keep and stuff. Like there's a little step up that you can take and have very little issues as well. So corn snakes can be like just a great starting off point.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you're looking at like a frame of reference for like any of the other pet snakes, like a ball python, you take it off of heat and just leave it at room temp. And you're not going to have a happy ball python at
no.
all.
No, it's very true.
My
ball python won't eat.
Yeah, and then if it eats, it's going to regurgitate, and it's probably going to decline very quickly after that.
Yeah.
You know, in comparison, it's just, they're such an interesting thing. And then with like king snakes and stuff, you got to worry about them biting and all that sort of stuff. And blah, blah, blah.
The fun of Lampropeltis. I think all of mine, as soon as I go to clean their enclosures, they're like ready to annihilate me.
Oh yeah!
I'm like, I don't even smell like food. I wasn't in the rodent room. I just happen to be something moving. Yeah, exactly. I'm like, I just happen to be moving in front of you. Yeah. I apologize that like, your food mode is at 100 right now.
Stop doing that. Stop moving. What are you doing?
I know. Sorry.
Yeah, I had to start. I had to start feeding in sneakers because I opened up a bin and Eastern Black Kingsnake launched out and just latched onto my fucking toe.
No. That's horrible. That's a terrible bite.
And they're just annoying. Imagine. Like, they don't like to let go. Uh-huh. Like, they don't get the point. They don't understand that you're not, like, they're the dumbest animals. I love them, but they're the dumbest animals. They don't understand what's food, what's not by any means, and they don't get it ever.
I had a scaleless Texas rat the other day, like, clamped onto my thumb and wrapped around me thinking I was food. And I was like, oh, my God, are we serious right now?
Yeah.
So just bring it over to the sink, water, run to it. And it unwrapped, but stayed chomped onto my thumb. And I'm like, really?
Oh,
really?
It's like that.
This
okay.
is what we're doing? And it took probably another, like, 2 or 3 minutes before it finally just, like, let go of my finger.
Wow.
And I was like, you're either you're very persistent. Hungry or just a general jerk. Like.
Oh, my God. So, Joe, you have been doing the podcast Port City, or sorry, From the Ground Up for a while now. How did you kind of come to doing podcasting?
So it's something that when I first got in the hobby, I mean, at the time I was listening to all different kinds of podcasts, but Reptile Radio I listened to a lot. Mm-hmm. It just seems like something in which I was able to consume easily because mm-hmm. I was always on the road. I was traveling a lot and doing a bunch of different things. So it was just, it's just kind of my preferred way to digest information.
Yeah.
So I was just a fan of podcasts. And then Morelia Python Radio guys came around and I just really loved their podcasts. And theirs just seemed a lot more down to my preferences and kind of sensibilities for, you know, the hobby and stuff like that and different things that are going on. So that really inspired me to do my own. Because, like, I wouldn't be able to do Reptile Radio. I mean, I'm not that guy, but when I saw someone doing it in like more of a niche type of situation and kind of more talking about things that I would ask, that's what really got me inspired to do it.
Mm-hmm. And then you also utilize YouTube as well and video for your podcast as well, right?
Yeah. So I've been doing YouTube live streams. Honestly, a lot less people engage in that, but you know, we have a nice little community of people who just kind of dick around on a Monday night. So it's nice. But yeah, otherwise, I used to do a lot of YouTube videos, and those are probably coming back pretty soon.
Cool. Yeah, I used to do YouTube videos back in the day, like when Brian started doing snake bites and all that sort of stuff. I made YouTube videos for a little while, and then my life just got too crazy. And I honestly really enjoy editing videos and putting together videos and stuff. So like when I was doing my own videos, I had a lot of fun doing it. And it's funny because, like, our camera guy up at Nerd, he's like, don't you just hate listening to your own voice? Like, when I'm editing videos, I hate hearing my own voice on the thing. And I'm like, I don't really care. Like, it doesn't bother me at all. I just like putting it together and kind of coming up with a different flow to the video. And I like all that sort of stuff. So I really like that.
Yeah, it just kind of comes down to a time thing. Yeah. It's so time intensive.
Yes.
So I respect anyone who's able to put out videos consistently. It's incredible, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seriously.
So were you planning on doing the YouTube and like having the podcast be a like available on apps outside of YouTube, or was that like something you came up with afterwards?
So the original intention was definitely to have the podcast to be more of a podcast. The YouTube live stream wasn't really intentional.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, it's kind of hard to think about now, but no one was doing any type of live YouTube show or like any type of live stream like that. Well, podcast wise in the reptile space.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It seemed easier to do it that way. I had the equipment in which I figured out how to basically capture, you know, the audio through interviewing in that way. So I just did it. I started YouTube before I started the podcast, although I had kind of the plan to do all media. So of course all the social media as well as YouTube and podcast. And I was doing daily vlogs actually for a while.
Oh, man, that's
for probably
tiring.
Like 3 months. Oh, it was terrible, man.
That just sounds
exhausting.
I was
a miserable human being.
Dude, I don't think I could ever get to the daily vlog level. Because that's just like, I feel like I would very much be the same where I'd be like just beat after the first week.
Mm-hmm.
And then be like, oh, here we go. I got this camera in my face. I got to be fucking happy. Way to go. Good choice, JT.
That's why I like my Instagram, because I just post stuff on my stories and it doesn't have to be like, oh, this is a thing. Look at how professional this is. It's just like, here's some memes. Have some fun. Here's some snakes.
I am low-key obsessed with your Instagram stories, bro.
I'm glad you're enjoying it.
I'm like, you know, political banter, foot fetish stuff.
Yep.
Occasional just like gore and coolness. I'm just like, fuck yeah, this is awesome. And I never really know what to expect, but I don't ever hate it.
Dude,
at the very least, I'm like, that's interesting.
I like that because I'm curious, because whenever I'm posting things, sometimes I'll post something like really messed up, and then afterwards I'll post something like super casual, and then I'm like, I wonder what people are thinking, like as they're like clicking through, they're like, oh, that's crazy, that's like a cool like cosplay thing, and all of a sudden it's like someone covered in blood with like holding pumpkins and stuff, and I'm like, that's a weird transition, and here's a picture of a snake too, and it's just like, you never know when you click that story icon what's going to pop up.
That is very true.
It's the best.
I just like to have fun with it. I think that's how I kind of try and have all my social medias. I just try and have fun with it, and I hope that people enjoy it. And if they don't, then don't follow me. I don't know what to tell you.
Well, yeah, like the way that you curate, say, your stories, you're only going to have a tribe of individuals who are cool and kind of get you in a way in which not many people will.
Yeah.
Because it's so like, it's so specifically curated to your personality.
Yes.
I think that's why it's cool.
Yeah. It's funny. You can tell who the people are who just started following me, because I'll post something like messed up on like my regular story, not my close friend story. Mm-hmm. And they'll respond back to it. They'll be like, what the fuck? And I'm like, oh, you're new here, aren't you? I love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. So what are like some projects that you're looking to like get into? Is there anything that you're like eyeballing right now and like, oh man, I gotta kind of get that. I'm interested in that.
So I did get some high orange gargoyle geckos.
Ooh.
So it's just something in which everyone goes for the red.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I really like the orange. It was kind of, it was one of my original colors in my logo. Mm-hmm. And I've always just liked orange. So yeah, I wanted to get as orange as possible. And yeah, they're super awesome. As far as any other projects, I picked up a Baron's Racer recently.
Hell yeah. That's cool. Hell yeah. I'm so about that. Those things are awesome.
So yeah, man, I just need a blue one now. I got the green yes. one. I could do without the brown. Sorry, folks. but I need a blue.
They're
the blues
so cool.
are silly.
You know,
yeah.
do you know Ryan Martinez, Zookeeper Ryan?
No.
You should hit him up because he works with rhinos, and I think he's got some barons too. But I'm pretty sure that he's working on a blue project, and he's got some really nice animal. I think you'd think he's interesting too. He's a really cool dude.
Yeah, yeah. I would love to reach out to him. Give me his info on Instagram.
I'll definitely shoot you a message afterwards and link you guys up because he's an awesome dude and he's got some really nice animals.
Yeah, because I know John Michaels had all of the color phases and he was doing a project, but I heard he got out of it. So I was a little concerned, like, who's picking up the ball here? Mm-hmm. Are there still going to be those projects?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. For the gargoyles, do you have a preference as far as like reticulated or striped? I mean, a lot of people are just like, striped, I want to see all the stripes. But I've seen some, like, when you mix the orange and the red stuff into reticulateds and you get like blotches on them, they look insane. They look so cool.
Yeah, I love kind of the splattered look. I don't have any, and I need to get some, but I actually do like that look better than the stripe. There is kind of a weird thing in reptiles. I tend to go for the things in which people don't naturally like gravitate to. So I kind of have this way of getting some things that I like as well as some things that I know people will like because I can't like sit on animals forever. Mm-hmm. Obviously I can keep a certain amount of animals back, but I don't want to get in a position where I ever have to like put an animal on sale and like really try to get it out or do anything like that. So I need to kind of keep in mind, you know, I can't produce, you know, 200 Eastern black king snakes. I could produce 10 and do amazing.
Yes.
if I bump that to like 30, I would be, you know, I'd be wholesaling them.
Yeah.
There's some markets that are just that tiny. And I think you kind of learn that in the reptile hobby rather quick when you mess that up.
Yeah, some people go gung-ho and they're like, oh, well, I can get $50 each for these, and if I produce 100 of them, you know, that's blah, blah, blah. And then you're like, well, you got to consider how many people are actually looking to buy that $50 yeah. snake because
right.
it might not be as high in your particular, you know, your reach, how many people you reach might not be all those people who are looking to buy that animal, even at the $50 price point.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a learned thing. Like, you don't know exactly how big the draw is going to be until it's there. And you can make some big mistakes if you go too gung-ho too quick.
Yeah.
Lucky enough, I've always been too broke to go too gung-ho.
I feel like that's one thing that's very easy to do with certain species. I mean, obviously, we've all met the people who go gung-ho with ball pythons mm-hmm. and just drop a shit ton of money on ball pythons. But even if you're doing something like corn snakes or carpet pythons or just anything that python wise it might be gets a little bit larger, or even boa constrictors, where you drop some money into it and you're like, yeah, you know, this is going to be cool, I can make X amount of money off of it, whatever, and then, you know, maybe you have that one season where you absolutely crush it and everything that you breed actually produces, and it's like, you know, at least 85% fertility mm-hmm. and viability out of the offspring, and all of a sudden you're like, yeah, you know, I should maybe see like 20 or 30 babies this year, and suddenly you've got like 75 or 100, you know,
babies.
Yeah, 120, whatever, and then you're like, shit,
oh, I gotta feed all these babies.
Yeah, I feel like especially with like corn snakes, just mm-hmm. because more often than not they're het for a bunch of other things that you're unaware of. So you're like, oh yeah, I'm going to breed this to this and I'm going to get blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden there's blah, blah, blah. But then there's six other things in that clutch that you were not expecting and that might not necessarily be as desirable as the other parts of that project. Then you're like, okay, what do I do with all of these?
What do I do now?
Yeah, I think that's, for me, that's definitely the fun part. I don't typically worry about selling a corn snake. I'm able to market to a level in which I can sell corn snakes pretty well. And like, I just like seeing different colors and stuff come out of the eggs. I'm pretty simple like that. I'm just like, different pattern, different color, neat. I didn't expect it. Awesome. And I don't. When it comes to that kind of stuff, I'm always into those surprises. That's kind of why I love corn. Another reason why I love corn snakes, basically.
Mm-hmm. For sure, yeah. Is there a specific mutation of corn snake that like consistently grabs your attention? Like I know for me, it's either anything that's blood red or anything that's butter. Anything that is any of those combos, I'm like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I think kind of the obvious one's palmetto.
Palmetto,
so I think that's kind of a cop out.
Yes.
That's kind of a cop out answer. But I mean that is a morph in which like I have oohed and aahed over for the last 8 years and I finally produced one. So
hell yeah.
So that's like that was just amazing. I love those snakes. You know, they do not have the best genetic pool, you know, or anything like that, unfortunately, so we're trying to tease that kind of stuff out. But what else would grab me as far as pied sided, diffused blood red, that kind of thing? Pied sided are great. But I really like a lot of my snow stuff. I know it's really simple, but something about white and pink snakes, to me it's like that should be the pinnacle. I don't know on what planet is it normal to make pink and white snakes? Like, and people are selling them on the table for like $25. To me, if I was to like take, you know, I don't know. There's plenty of ball pythons that are very expensive that are pretty drab coloration. And then I have this little pink and white snake, man. I don't know. To me, that's like, it doesn't get much better than that. I could never, it just seems unreal to have a snake that's pink and white. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like the candy cane corns where they're like that bright, bright white and red. And it's like, how is this only, you know, a $50 or $100 snake? I don't even understand. This thing is like, it literally looks like a candy cane. It's bright red. And like most red snakes or white snakes and like red and white, they're like a couple $100. But just because it's a corn snake, they're like, it's cheap. You know?
Yeah, $50.
Yeah, luckily that's changing now.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. But yeah, think about candy cane. That's probably, I mean, that's easily 25 years of selective breeding.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In corn snakes in particular, they're kind of relics as far as captive breeding really started in colubrids and genetics really started in corn snakes. So ball pythons, they're kind of new kids, you know, just late 90s, that kind of thing. But corn snakes go all the way back to the 70s and 80s and have been being line bred since then. And no one has really focused on line breeding many ball pythons in particular. So I think that kind of gives corn snakes a leg up on the just it would be very hard for you to just hatch out a candy cane. But someone did, you know, 25 years of work before you and you're able to do it. It just I don't know. It's nice.
I definitely
would agree with that. And like we were just talking about that on one of the actually multiple different episodes of the podcast, talking about like nobody's really taken that time with ball pythons to find some interesting polygenic trait and just work it, you know, and get it into another project and or just kind of expand and see how crazy they can make it. So I feel like that avenue is still very much alive for ball pythons should someone actually want to do it. But you know, ball pythons are basically always marketed as the snake that you purchase to breed.
Yeah.
you know, right. And doesn't necessarily get publicized much of any other way. Just like, look at this cool snake I made. You can make it too, but you have to give me a lot of money.
Right. And it's about stacking the genes. It's not about even just producing another animal. It's about putting more things into that.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't want to say that no one's working with that kind of stuff, because I believe there's a guy named Andy Grossman, and I think he has a wild type ball python selected breeding project. So that's
awesome.
The kind of shit that you can get behind right there.
Yeah, no, for sure, man. I mean, I just think about like the original like pastel stuff for ball pythons back in the day. You'd like Kevin had the lemon line pastel, then there was the citrus pastel, there was Graziani line pastel, like. You know, these guys were like, they found their little desired piece in each line and just kind of went with it. And then as more genes became available, it was, just like you said, it was about like stacking stuff and just trying to make the coolest looking animal versus, you know, just like the most insane looking pastel that you can find.
Yeah, I mean, they honestly did so much work in such a small time frame. As far as like those pastels, now people are probably kind of pass those off as almost normals. What they started out with. I mean, I think a lot of them were, eye color, right? So a lot of them had green eye color, and that was a very distinctive thing. But then just by the early 2000s, you were already having incredible pastels in just like 2 to 3 generations.
Yeah, exactly.
What I want to see is someone line breeding for size. I want someone to make 8-foot long ball pythons. I've seen some 6-footers.
Where are those Volta folks?
Right, yeah. Right. I imagine if they just like took a couple generations of just picking out their biggest babies and then raising them up and then breeding those and taking the biggest babies. I want to see a 7 or 8 foot long ball python.
Dude, Steve Tillis could probably make that happen.
He's got a
6 foot
one, man. Yeah, his locale, the locale ball pythons he's got, they're probably like 5.5, almost 6 foot.
6 foot, yeah.
So I would love to see some giant. Imagine someone walks up with a 7 foot ball python. I'd just be like, okay.
The stories are true.
Okay, that's cool.
The stories are true.
Yeah.
You do have a 7 foot ball python.
Yeah. Besides all the people who call our store and they're like, we have a 10 foot long ball python, and they bring it in and it's 3.5 feet long, and I'm like, how?
Or it's not even a ball python.
Yeah, it's a king snake. They're like, I've had this ball python for 20 years, and you're like,
oh,
that's not even what you thought it was.
That's cool.
So how do you navigate? Because I'm curious, because obviously I don't think a lot of people know that there's a store underneath your facility,
yeah,
right?
Pet store, yeah. We have the full pet store called Zoo Creatures.
So as far as like that store goes, I'm sure you're having so many people try to like drop off random animals,
yep,
or like rescue animals and that stuff. How do you usually navigate those situations?
We actually charge people to drop animals off because a lot of times they're not in the greatest health. We got to feed them. We got to take care of them until they're well enough where we can screen them, make sure that they're healthy before we offer them to a new home. In 2018, I think it was 2018, we had over 1,000 reptiles brought and dropped off to our store.
Whoa.
Yeah.
In 1 year.
1 year. Yep.
So that's like three, it's like 2.5 a day.
Yes, pretty much. Yeah. There was
what
days.
The hell?
Yeah. It was a lot. And you know, a lot of people will call us and they'll get upset and they'll be like, well, you're charging me to take my animal that you're going to sell. And we're like, yeah, but like, you don't understand how many people are like, oh, I take great care of my leopard gecko and it's awesome. And then they bring it in and things got MBD. Its legs are like curled up into little pretzels. And like, it's horrible. Like some of the things that we've seen, and the people don't even realize that anything's wrong.
Yeah.
And, giving the care to those animals and doing whatever's best for that animal long term, it's not free. It costs us money to do that, in man hours and medicine and all this different stuff. So, you know, we do charge a small fee for people to drop off animals with us. But those people do that and they know that that animal is going to get taken care of and it's going to find a new home. We've had a lot of people that are moving out of country, like they're moving from one situation to another and they can't bring their pets with them, and they'll bring them to us. We'll set them up, screen them, and then find new homes for them. But I've seen a lot of people who are like, oh, I'm moving to Switzerland and I can't bring my, you know, 5 ball pythons with me. So here, you guys can take them or whatever.
Right.
But it's, it's funny because a lot of people come to Nerd and they see our reticulated pythons that we sell them, and they're like, oh, you must get a lot of people bringing back, you know, 15-foot and 20-foot long snakes because they don't know what they're getting into. And I'm like, the amount of time I've been at Nerd full time for almost 5 years now, and I can count on both hands the number of retics that have been dropped off. So over 5 years, it's been under 10 animals. But I can't tell you how many bearded dragons, leopard geckos, and ball pythons, because people are like, they're just too much to take care of. And I'm like, your ball python, the thing you got to do like 10 minutes a week to take care of, that's what's too much to take care of. It's crazy. It's just so weird to me, because you would think that like all these big monitors and reticulated pythons and big stuff would be the stuff that we see all the time, but it's not. It's usually like leopard geckos and ball pythons.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think it's probably pretty easy to put up a quick Craigslist ad and say I have a 16-foot snake and someone will snatch it up.
Probably.
In comparison to like another ball python, another leopard gecko.
Yeah.
No, it's very true. It's it certainly does get frustrating though, especially when we're already sometimes limited on space.
Yes.
You know, and you know, we certainly have had to turn people away.
Yep.
Just
especially turtles. People with turtles are the worst, because we try not to sell people on turtles, like, unless they're like diehard, I love my turtle, I'm gonna do everything to take care of it right, because we get a lot of people who are like, I want a $30 turtle and it's a small one. I just want like a small turtle. And I'm like, you know that it's not just gonna stay like a little 3-inch turtle, right? You know that it's going to get bigger and you're going to have to get a bigger enclosure and filtration and lighting and all this stuff. And they're like, well, I just want like a little turtle. And you're like, no, because you're going to come back here in 5 years when it's, you know, a foot long, and you're going to say, well, I can't take care of it anymore. And then we're going to have like a lot of pet stores just get overwhelmed with the amount of aquatic turtles that are brought to them, because there's so many people that get them when they're little, and it's cute and it's entertaining for a little bit. And then once they get to be, you know, 8 inches, 10 inches long, they're a lot of work, and they can be smelly in your house, and, you know, they can be an eyesore if you're not keeping up with them. So we get a lot of people who are like, you know, we want to drop off turtles, and we have to turn a lot of them away because we just don't have the room to take all those turtles that get dropped off.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen just down here in the canal in Philly, like in the middle of the city, there's so many red-eared sliders.
Yeah.
And I forget, I think there's a zoo somewhere that I went recently. Maybe they took in a bunch of animals that people dropped off, and they had thousands of red-eared sliders, thousands in this pond, like almost crawling on top of each other.
Yep.
It's crazy.
It really is ridiculous, the number of in particular red-eared sliders, and I think painted turtles would probably be the two most common. But like, I remember when I was on the board for the New England Herp Society, I think every single month there were no less than 10
red-eared
sliders on the adoption list.
Yep.
You know, and it was just like, oh my gosh. Like, wow.
People don't realize how big they get. They see the little cute turtle and they're like, oh, it's just a cute turtle. And it's like, every baby animal gets to be an adult animal at some point.
Yeah. But it's still just a cute turtle.
Yeah.
And I mean, dirty, dirty creatures.
Very, very dirty.
But I mean, like, go back to, if you know anyone who's gotten salmonella, turtle's pretty bad.
Yes. Yeah. I can't even. No.
Yeah, I'm not about it. I have a redfoot tortoise, and that's my only.
Oh, it's with your parents. I was like, you have a.
That's with my parents. Yeah.
You have a tortoise. I was like, you're hiding things. He's the host with me here, and he's hiding things from me.
Oh, dude. You don't know me, bruh. You don't know me.
I had a red-eared slider when I was growing up. That was given to me. One of my friends from school didn't want it anymore and ended up bringing it to me. And so when I did educational programs, I would bring that with me to every single program and be like, look, I know you want a baby turtle, but this is what they get into. Cause it was like a foot long. It was huge. And I was like, this is what it grows to be. Do not just go on a whim and get a baby turtle. Don't do it. You're going to regret it. It's not everything that it's cracked up to be. I know they're cool. I know that they got the cute little shell, but they are not the pet that you think that they are. They're super duper not.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird, like, tortoises, like, my nephew has a little Greek tortoise, and I mean, they're great as far as keeping's pretty simple. And they also just don't really smell and have any of the keeping up. You basically have to keep a fish tank, right?
Water for, changes.
Say, ready as spider and stuff like that. But yep. Yeah, I mean, besides living 100 years, tortoise is pretty sweet.
Yeah, I definitely think that's, you know, the other big aspect of turtles and tortoises, just that lifespan, man. Mm. Like, if you aren't ready for that, you know, the little turtle growing into the big turtle is one thing, but then realizing, like,
you got to give it to your kids, maybe your grandkids. Yeah,
that thing's going to be in your will.
Yes.
Like, if you know what you're doing, that thing should outlive you, probably outlive your kids.
Yep.
And could potentially outlive your grandkids, depending on.
Could you imagine?
Yeah. Depending on what species, man.
Yeah.
You know, it's a possibility.
Aldabras,
that's right.
Oh, yeah.
It's blown my mind, the popularity of Aldabras in the U.S. hobby over the last 5 years.
Yeah.
It's insane. Like, I looked at Aldabras and, like, Galapagos, and I'm like, oh, that's a really cool thing that I would like to see at a zoo, but I don't know if people own them. And then all of a sudden, I'm seeing them at Tinley, and I'm seeing them, like, on for sale on Fauna all over the place. And
yep.
People are like, I need to get an Aldabra. And I'm like, what are you going to do with an Aldabra tortoise? Like, realistically, what are you going to do with an Aldabra? You're going to need a forklift to move it.
Let your child ride it around the backyard and mow the lawn.
Yeah. And what are you going to do when you need to move it from one side of your lawn to the other side of the lawn if it's getting cold outside? Like, I don't...
Well, don't own it if you live in a cold climate.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
That's the trick.
Yeah.
Or you have your child sit on top of it and hold a stick out with a leaf of lettuce or a carrot in front of it, and you guide it.
I just, like, I see the – when I think of, like, a big Aldabra, what I think of is the picture of the sulcata tortoise coming through the drywall into the person's bathroom.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, okay, now think about how big an Aldabra is. Like – it'll ruin your house. Absolutely ruin your house.
100%. 100%. Yes.
It'll go into your basement, and then it has to stay with the house after a certain point because you can't get it out of the basement. Yeah. Like, what?
Yeah, I
what
don't
even?
Think people don't realize that some of these guys do live in burrows, like, say, sulcatas and stuff like that. And, like, you can have a fence in your backyard. Homeboy's right going to go under it. He's going to try to go over it. He's going to every which way.
Go right
pretty
through
pretty
it.
Sneaky animals for slow bastards.
It's true. It definitely is true. I when we were just at Barcheck's place, you know, he's got Speedy, his sulcata, in, and they just have him kind of roaming the colubrid room. That motherfucker
can
run
book.
Some laps.
Yeah.
He can run some laps, man. I was like, oh, there goes Speedy. And then, like, less than a minute later, you're like, oh, there goes Speedy.
He's on the other side of the room.
Yeah, how did that happen? You know, like, dude. And he's a good-sized sulcata, too. Mm. He's probably at least 18 inches in diameter.
Jeez.
You know, that's good. I'm amazed he doesn't break the colubrid rest.
That's what I was just about to say.
I'm like, I guess you're just running out the energy in this rectangle here, but, you know, sheesh.
So what was Southeast Carpet Fest? Was that the first Carpet Fest that you've been to, or you go to the OG?
No, so I've gone to Southern a few times. I've gone to Northeast, and then that was my first time at Southeast.
Yeah, that was my first Carpet Fest, and it was my first Southeast Carpet Fest. So it was definitely interesting to check out, and that was the last fun to be had in 2020 for most people. <It's> like,
yeah, that was game over after that. Yeah,
yeah, very true.
You get back home, and everyone's like, COVID, 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 and you're like, ah,
like,
damn
cool.
It. Self-quarantine for 2 weeks.
Yeah, there goes the rest of my year.
6 months later.
Yeah, dude, I thought that we were talking a few weeks, a month.
Yeah. I was like,
months at both.
2 months, this will be done. We're at Halloween. Everyone's like, wear your fucking masks. What are you doing?
Yeah, legit.
Oh, not good. Not good at all.
No, I think what I miss a lot, honestly, man, is reptile shows.
For
and,
real.
Yep.
Like, I used to do at least, like, two every month. And that's really different, like, traveling around the country. And, like, you know, I went to New Orleans last year. I went to, obviously, the Carpet Fest. I went to places all around PA, Baltimore, stuff like that. And it's, like, it's nice to travel to get out. Now we're just kind of stuck. And it's nice to talk to people because you realize that keeping snakes alone is only so much fun.
That's true. The aspect of the community is certainly huge.
Oh, yeah, it keeps you going. It's what it's like what I see as one of like the biggest points of staying in the hobby mm-hmm. is getting connected with the individuals. Like the animals, you're gonna wax and wane as far as like you're not always gonna feel as passionate, but you may get a call from a guy who's passionate and then you're like, oh yeah, I remember why I do this.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. I think that probably is my favorite part of the job is like, you know, getting a deal with a customer or you know, whatever, or at a reptile show, you know, and you talk to that person who they've like just got bit by the bug, you know, they just got that spider. They're yep. like, man, I freaking love these things. They're so fucking awesome, man. Like, blah, blah, blah. Like that. You're like, hell yeah, dude. Like, yes, this is awesome. And I appreciate the random caffeine boost of energy.
I literally
just had that experience now with someone called me on the phone on the way home and he's like, send me all the king snake pictures. He's like, he's sending me king snake pictures all day. And I'm like, you just having this enthusiasm is making me feel just so much better at what I do, to be honest. Cause it's also like someone in which aspires to be where you are now, which like for me, I live a very simple life. There's nothing extravagant. For you guys, it's a little bit more. It's a little bit cooler. It's a lot of bit cooler. So people aspiring to be me or to be you, when you stop basically realizing that you live a cool life and then someone pretty much reminds you of it. Or at least that, like, sometimes I think, like, oh, I'm a snake loser alone in my house. And then someone thinks I'm cool or, you know, thinks yeah. it's cool that I have a room full of snakes. It's cool.
Yeah. I'd certainly appreciate the people that are like, oh, yeah, that's pretty cool versus the people who are like, what do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, that's why, I mean, honestly, do you guys usually say, do you usually divulge this information, like, I don't know. At work, you end up becoming like the snake guy or something if you work a normal job. Or if you just say one thing, you become that guy.
Well, okay, so I'll tell you my synopsis for dating, because that's always really difficult. Oh, so I always lead off with the fact that I'm a musician first.
Yep.
and then I'll lead into any other like projects I've done with animals that aren't necessarily my own. So like when I was working with UMass Amherst on the Digital Life 3D stuff, mm-hmm. I was like, oh yeah, yeah, I work at a university and with this project and blah blah blah, we work with animals and oh that's really cool. Do you do anything else with animals? And you're like, now the door is open. And you're like, check this out. And if you don't run away, then we can talk about date number two.
I feel like I am so heavily into reptiles that it's all the other aspects of my life that make people think I'm weird. So like the reptile thing, I that's all I post, so like anyone who might have felt one way or another about it is long, long, long gone, and the only people who are finding me now are reptile people, so it's not usually anything, you know, besides that, you know, I don't know, I feel like I'm just like the reptile, I'm the reptile guy everywhere I go, but
that's fair. Dude, I'm gonna start introducing you as that.
Do it.
This is Rob the reptile guy.
It's better than a bunch of the other people who was like, this is Rob, he's the foot guy. And I'm like, oh, why'd you have to start with that? You got to warm people up to that. You don't just throw that right on the table at first.
Damn.
Yeah. Snakes are one thing.
Yeah, that's true. I guess so.
All right, man. So we are winding down our time here. But we ask everybody one closing question, the one question to rule them all. And that question is, what in the realm of reptiles, be it a project that you're working on, something that you've seen on the internet, a project that you've been watching progress and grow, or a place that you've visited, what in the realm of reptiles has got you excited about reptiles right now?
Ooh, I'm really hesitating to say this, but I'll say it because whoever has made it this far in the podcast is cool.
Yes.
And this is seriously what I am so fucking excited about. So this, I told you guys that I couldn't do this later because I have a flight early in the morning. I'm flying out to Charlotte to meet with my partner to find a space to open a store in Charlotte.
Oh, damn. That's fucking dope. Awesome. Hell yeah. Dude, I'm about awesome. It. That's so cool.
So, dude, I've been trying, like, just not to say anything for a while. But it's like, yeah, it's happening. So I'm super fucking pumped about it. Like,
hell yeah, dude.
Fuck yeah.
It's the dream, man.
Hell yeah. If you ever have questions or anything like that about shops and any of that, do not be afraid to shoot us a message.
That's why I was asking that question, but I wasn't going to say it. yeah, man, I have, because I was asking you a question about the pet store earlier, so I got so many fucking questions.
Don't be afraid,
honest.
Dude.
You're gonna hate
me. No, I don't think so. I think that we're cool.
Yeah, hell yeah.
I am so pumped about that. That's super fucking exciting. Congratulations, man. Dude, yeah, that's awesome.
Oh, dude, we're doing multi-species, hopefully a whole living wall, paludarium with neon tetras, a, like, black Amazon forest.
Oh, hell yeah.
Like, water tank.
Badass.
And with a mata-mata in it,
yes!
And some emerald tree boas,
yes!
And some yellow-headed geckos,
dude,
just roaming around.
Oh, hell yeah, dude.
Fucking mint. That's so cool.
Dude, so, there's so many things.
All I'm saying is we need an invite to the grand opening.
Yeah, for reals, though.
That's, you know.
We will be there. I'll be there. Jeremy will be
yep,
there.
Yep, I'll be there.
we're doing it.
Hell yeah.
100%.
All right, man. So that's winding down our time, but thank you so much for coming on tonight. I appreciate it so much, man. It's been great talking to you.
Yes,
and
sir.
We'll have to have you on again sometime soon.
Absolutely, guys. Fun times, and you guys will have to reciprocate, and you'll have to come on the podcast sometime.
Yeah, hell yeah. Anytime you want, just let us know.
Hell yeah, guys.
All right, take care.
Have a nice day. Later.